These people who run the world understand sheeple better than you would ever believe. And you'd better quit being sheeple right this moment. You'd better pull the wool out from over your eyes. Take off that fur coat. Stand up on your own 2 feet. Stop buying. Get ready to fight for your freedoms or lose them all very shortly.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Marnus Tin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Exactly a year since the Idlib chemical weapons attack. Here we are again, but how many times can the war faction pull the old WMD scam? In half an hour or so, we'll be looking at the Polonium files. Vladimir Putin, the killer of Alexander Litvinenko, who just tried to kill former Russian spy Sergei Skripal in Salisbury 2. Also, the killer of the brilliant Russian investigative journalist Anna Politkovskaya. She was killed by a hitman with a baseball cap. Of course, all these people must have been killed by the evil mastermind Vladimir Putin. Or were they? After all, Libya wasn't necessarily behind the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher or Lockerbie. Potentially rogue elements from our own side. That didn't stop the London media pinning the blame on Gaddafi, though. So we look at the background of Politkovskaya's 2006 murder tonight, the same time as Litvinenko, a shocking investigation she was doing earlier that year into corrupt officials in the FSB and Chechen Secret Service, covering up horrifically, motiveless, apparently anyway, poisonings of scores of Chechen schoolchildren with what is now thought was probably polonium. So who was the mastermind behind Politkovskaya's murder? Was it Putin or someone else? Someone, perhaps, with a motive to kill two birds with one stone. To silence Politkovskaya and pin the blame on their arch-enemy, Vladimir Putin. That was then, but today, 12 years later, Russia is threatening to sink NATO naval ships, to shoot down British aircraft if we use them to attack anyone who's fighting ISIS or other Syrian terrorists. So this weekend, the United Nations, Britain and NATO stand on the brink of war, do they? With Russia, and Syria is the prize. The background, well, is 100 or so, or nearly 100, expulsions of Russian diplomats after the Skripal Salisbury nerve agent poisoning happened around a month ago. Joining us to delve between the lines and sort the facts from the spin behind the Skripal story and last weekend's alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma is Bath University's Professor David Miller. Hi, David. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you.
David, you wrote a piece for Open Democracy about this. Can you just sum up where you're coming from, looking at both? I mean, obviously, that was about the Skripal affair, and the chemical weapons attack in Douma has happened since then. But where are you coming from?
Well, the thing which caught my attention was the phrase which the British government started to use in all its announcements early on in the Skripal case, which was that the agent which had been used to poison these two was of a type developed by Russia. Now, this was a phrase which I thought was odd, and Craig Murray did a good job of exposing and delving into what it meant. But it struck me as very similar to phrases I'd heard before when I'd been investigating when I was a mere young thing, the killings of three members of the IRA in Gibraltar. Now, casting your mind back to that time, there were three members of the IRA were shot dead by the SAS with their hands in the air, and it was said that they were planning a bombing, that a car bomb, a suspect car bomb, had been dealt with. Now, there wasn't any car bomb in Gibraltar, and it emerged later at the inquest that the phrase "a suspect car bomb" is what the Ministry of Defence termed a term of art. That is a term which they think is accurate, but which can be used to mislead people, i.e. can be used to suggest that there is something there which is not there, and they can then pretend that they were just being honest by saying, well, we only suspected something was there, and it turned out there wasn't. And the phrase of a type developed by Russia seemed to me to be exactly similar. It was a phrase intended to suggest that the Russians were responsible for the poisoning, but with the deniability that when it was revealed that they hadn't got the evidence for that, they could say, well, we only said that it was developed by Russia. We didn't say that the Russians did it. So my approach to this is to say, well, you know, let's pay careful attention to the words that are spoken by our government, because they spend a lot of time crafting those phrases to try and make it seem like they're telling the truth, and they use those phrases to suggest something quite different, in this case, that the Russians were responsible. So that's where I'm coming from in this is to pay close attention to, especially British government statements and propaganda, and that's in the context, I think, of something which many people maybe are not aware of, which is that the British government employs thousands and thousands of people to come up with what they've described in various places as deceptions to mislead people about how the world operates. Thousands of people who are employed in the Government Information Service to do all sorts of propaganda activities. And people don't know that there are literally thousands of those people. I did a talk recently in London, and I mentioned the thousands of people, and some people came up to me afterwards and said, really? There's really thousands of people? So I went away and did this article for Open Democracy, like listing the people. So there's 3,500 who are listed as being communications professionals within government, and of course there are several others, hundreds of others.
But I mean,
aren't these people not listed?
Just press officers?
They are press officers, that's right, and they're the people who get together to make sure that they can come up with a line which they can give to the media and which can foster the ideas that the government wants. And in particular, in cases of foreign policy, where there are matters of what they refer to as national interest at stake, their history is that they will use these phrases effectively to lie.
But don't these press officers actually really just broker deals between press researchers, producers, etc., and government ministers, government spokespeople that can then they're there to facilitate people just getting onto television or whatever?
Well, they are there to do that, and they're also there to facilitate what the line's going to be and what exactly they're going to say. And that's one of the things about the Skripal case was that the Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, of course, went further than the briefing line and said, no, actually, there's no doubt it came from Russia. The people at Portendown have told me this. Now, of course, that was a very difficult thing for the scientists at Portendown to cope with. They'd gone along with the phrase of a type developed by Russia. And when Johnson goes onto television and simply lies about it, it's very difficult for them to actually go along with those lies. And that's why you saw subsequently the head of Portendown coming out and saying that they didn't know where it came from.
Okay, so this idea, we've got to keep a very, very close eye on what we're being told, Dennis. That's what you're saying. When a word or a phrase like that is used. One of the phrases or words I've heard used recently quite a lot is this idea of the word probably. For example, when we had the inquiry into the death of Alexander Litvinenko, the final conclusion by the judge was that probably Putin was behind the death of Alexander Litvinenko. More recently, we had Gary Aitkenhead, who's the boss of Portendown, the government's chemical weapons centre just outside Salisbury, saying that the perpetrator or whoever manufactured the Novichok nerve agent was probably a state actor. So this word probably doesn't necessarily say that there's any conclusion been drawn by them.
That's right, and in relation to the agent that's been used in relation to gas attacks and chemical attacks or alleged chemical attacks in Syria, and with the Skripal case, they say things like an agent which is a Novichok or something similar, and the question is, we don't know how much wiggle room there is in the phrase or something similar, and they put that in there deliberately to cover themselves, and partly, you know, it's because they're not really certain, but they can also use it as a device to mislead us deliberately.
One of the things I've seen on the BBC, I'm not sure if Sky have been doing it, with the footage of last Saturday's horrendous looking chemical weapons attack, is that there's a little line at the bottom of the screen saying we cannot verify this footage.
Unverified, yeah. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of heat and anger about this, isn't there? Especially on the left, really, where anyone who raises questions about what might have happened, whether it's happened, who might be responsible, is seen as being the enemy of the Syrian people. Now, of course, everyone is clear that the Syrian people have gone through an appalling hardship over the last 7 years for a variety of reasons, and we should be very clear that no one is suggesting that that's not happened. Of course, it's happened, but the question that for those who are raising questions is to say, well, what exactly has gone on here? Is there some doubt? When one sees these reports as being unverified, we think, well, you know, let's have some verification. Let's have the OPCW going in there and testing, and crucially, of course, before there is precipitate military action taken on the basis of what's not certain. Because, of course, and people say this is not Iraq, it's not Libya. Well, maybe it's not Iraq or it's not Libya, but it doesn't really matter where you are in the world. The government will lie about it if they want to invade.
Are there no checks and balances on the government? Don't they have to tell the truth? I mean, to a certain extent, you could say that, well, they are telling. They're not lying quite. That what they're doing is they're using words like probably to get off the hook.
Yeah, they want to have the appearance of reality and the appearance of truth. And that's what you saw that when we had the Chilcot inquiry into Iraq, where you saw the successive drafts of the dossier where they redrafted it and redrafted it and redrafted it until they were able to cultivate the impression they wanted, which was there was a genuine threat from Saddam Hussein, which was not true. And that was based on the intelligence they had, but it was based on in a way which was distorted and which was there to cultivate the idea that the opposite of the truth was the case. And so I mean, in the Iraq case, of course, there's not really any doubt that they lied, but they try their best to use words in a way which can be defensible, but which, when they use them, can be suggested to mean something else.
Well, Tory MP Joe Johnson was on the BBC's Question Time last night, and you mentioned a minute ago, David, the idea that there's these PR people behind the scene trying to really give a script to politicians as to what they should be saying when they get on the media. And there was a fascinating incident right towards the beginning of the program where Joe Johnson, he seemed to have some sort of device, maybe an iPhone or something, in his pocket, in his breast pocket, and it started speaking, and it started speaking quite loud, to such an extent that it could be quite easily picked up by his tie mic that was right next to it. And it was saying some quite interesting things, because the great thing about television is that if it's been recorded, some bright spark somewhere will put it up on YouTube or somewhere, and then there's various people trying to interpret. Okay, so what was that voice saying? This someone did that last night, and I had a look at it today. What this device apparently was saying, because Joe Johnson does talk over it a little bit, but you can hear the voice fairly clearly say something like, "I found something on the weapon in Syria, and it's also decided that we must tell the media." Now, this clearly is not an ordinary report. It's something to do with schooling potentially politicians. But anyway, I thought it would be good idea to just have a listen to that now. And we're going to have a direct, unedited little clip from Question Time, followed by just that little section where this voice in Joe Johnson's chest is speaking to us, and before he manages to switch it off. Let's have a listen to that now.
Action. Are you talking about action agreed with the United States and France?
Yeah, what's been agreed in Cabinet today is that the government, led by the Prime Minister, should continue to work closely
Okay, so at least allegedly what's being said by this little voice and this machine that he has to switch, the iPhone, he has to switch off in the middle of live question, well, it's actually not live, but obviously the BBC decided to include that in the broadcast version, is something along the lines of, "We found something on the weapon in Syria, and it's also been decided that we must tell the media," at which point he switches this thing off. Now, what could be going on there, David? It doesn't sound like this is just an ordinary news report that's playing out, does it?
It sounds a little bit like Siri, isn't it? It's like, you know, it's like he's asked Siri on his phone, what should we do about Syria? And Siri goes back and says, I'll find this stuff on the web, what you could tell him. No, I mean, it's something that's being briefed to him, isn't it? No doubt they have that kind of briefing all the time. I'm not sure why it would be, why it would come out live like that. But of course, that's how it works. There are briefings and there are agreements about what line to take, and sometimes the minister ignores them, like Boris Johnson apparently does. But that's what the whole edifice is for. That's what the thousands and thousands of people inside government are there to do, to make sure that the government and the politicians say things which can pursue their interests.
There's something quite wonderful about the idea that the veil is sort of lifted. It's almost like the Wizard of Oz or something. The veil is lifted just for a moment on BBC.
Well, we're in an era of the veil being lifted, aren't we? I mean, it used to be the case before social media that the lies that the government told to get us into wars would take months, sometimes years, to come out. The My Lai Massacre took ages to come out. The lies about the Falklands War took a long time to get out. But in the age of the internet and people being able to check stuff, the lies about Iraq were revealed within days. The dossier, which was plagiarised from a postgraduate student's thesis, the stuff about the WMDs and the 45 minutes from disaster and the intelligence underlying that, again, exposed within days, not by mainstream journalists, but by bloggers and academic researchers. And that's the era we're now in. It's very difficult for them to get away with lies for very long. I mean, in the case of the Skripals, they got away with the lies for a very significant period, including, you know, gulling some people on the left, including John McDonnell, Paul Mason, to go along with the lies. But they were found out because the DSTL, the Porton Down, had to come out and make the scientific statement, which undermined the whole case.
Well, look, let's go back to Iraq, because it does seem to be quite a lot of parallels there. The problem is, if you look at the mainstream press that we're supposed to trust, the BBC, there were really two main people at the BBC that were telling us that the dodgy dossier was dodgy and that we shouldn't trust it. One of them was the journalist Andrew Gilligan on the Today programme. The other was the Director General Greg Dyke, both of whom were sacked as a result. So the only people who were actually rooting for us and trying to tell the truth were removed from their jobs.
Well, I would be hard-pressed to admit that I thought that Andrew Gilligan and Greg Dyke were rooting for us, I mean, especially given Andrew Gilligan's subsequent record, his deeply Islamophobic coverage of Muslim issues. So, yeah, I mean, the people who tell the truth in the BBC are very
telling
minimal.
The truth by accident?
No, I think Gilligan's case, that was his brief, was to dig up stuff, and the stories he had there were true and substantially true in the case of the David Kelly case. And Greg Dyke, you know, came from a background which meant that he was less well disposed to the kind of lying which the Blair era sort of required. But let's be clear, the mainstream media are not places where you dig up truth about power anymore. If they ever were, maybe they were in the 1970s and early 80s. And if you remember back to then, there were times when the government was seriously pissed off with broadcasters, with Panorama, with World in Action. That doesn't happen anymore because the mainstream media, including the documentaries and the investigative programs, don't really investigate things properly anymore. And that's a real problem for us. But the problem is not that of the sheeple, as you have at the beginning of your program. It's a problem. Because it allows the government to do what they want for perhaps particular periods of time, but actually in the contemporary era, many, many more thousands of people than before disbelieve what the powerful say, and we're in an era where that disbelief is generalised, and is, you know, in this country is leading to a surge in support for a radical left wing Labour Party.
You mentioned Islamophobia briefly there. Noticed this week something which hadn't really been reported very much, but that's President Macron in France demanding state control over the finances of mosques throughout the country. Now, surely this is a really quite shocking intervention and goes against all kinds of basic conventions like the UN Convention of Human Rights, allowing freedom of faith and worship, this sort of thing. So the French government actually wants to take control of the finances of all the mosques in France. Now, why hasn't that received more coverage, maybe?
Well, we're in a period where the attack on the right of Muslims to participate in public life has grown and grown, and it's not just in France. The French, we might argue, are a bit worse than other countries, but What is happening in Britain is appalling. You know, the ability to be active in political life while being a Muslim who opposes the British war or whatever is very, very difficult. We've had organisations who've had their bank accounts closed down, who've had their children's bank accounts closed down. We've got daily attacks in the streets against Muslims, attacks on mosques, firebombs.
That's the banks themselves doing that, not the government.
These things are not just the banks doing them themselves. These are, for example, in the case of the bank accounts, it was based on a database, the World Check database run by Thomson Reuters, who are now paying out millions of pounds in compensation to some of the people who were wronged. But the databases are of people who are terrorists, and this is data which is gathered and collected and shared by commercial organisations, yes, but also by political organisations, including states. So there's a real problem here with representing and marginalising Muslim political activists as being extremists, and that's been done because they fear the threat of a vibrant anti-war movement which almost brought stopped the Iraq war happening. That's what they want to stop. So to do that, they have to present ordinary Muslims engaged in political activities in this country as extremists.
Thomson Reuters, we don't often hear much mention of them, although a lot of their news is printed all over our newspapers, quite often without any mention of them. Where are they? Are they these powerful news wire organisations? Where are they coming from? I suppose I should really start by asking about where their finance comes from.
The finance for
Thomson Reuters. Where does most of the money come from? Because that's bound to determine, as they're pretty much unregulated, what their priorities are.
Well, that's a complicated question, Tony. But
I think a lot of it comes from. Someone I interviewed on here a couple of years ago was saying he worked for Reuters, was saying that actually a lot of the money for Reuters comes from the financial services industry, who pay them a vast amount of money for giving share prices right around the world, and that this sort of has a direct effect on the priorities of the people running the company.
I think that's true. I mean, these media institutions, people think of them as producing news that we see in the papers every day, and of course they do, but they also do other stuff, including for the financial industry, but also for the security industry, and that's what the World Check database was about. It's about compiling data on individuals who can be said to be extremists, whether they're Muslims or environmentalists. I'm sure you're on a list somewhere, Tony. And that kind of activity is also communication activity, in a sense that it's used by other corporations and governments to check people whether they're going to give them jobs or give money to their organisations, etc. So that's a whole edifice which is raised up upon the war on terror.
So they could ruin your career.
Well, they do ruin people's careers, yeah, that's right.
Also, on the subject of social media, we had a fascinating hearing with Mark Zuckerberg in front of the Senate. I'm not quite sure which committee it was, judicial committee perhaps. But anyway, it was interesting to see his reaction. Very, very schooled. He didn't seem to be. But one of the most fascinating questions which was asked to him, I thought, was this thing of which hotel did you sleep in last night? And there was someone else asked, so the same guy actually asked him, who were you messaging last week? Are you happy to tell us now? Because that's the information that you have about all of your users. So there is obviously, we've got into an area, it seems to me, with social media, where we're giving up a fantastic amount of our own personal information. For example, if you install the Facebook app on your phone, well, you're giving it permission to effectively harvest all of your phone contacts, all your SMS messages, all this kind of stuff. So I wonder if it's just that this isn't being regulated and these companies are, in a way, a kind of front end for people who are able then to use and sell that data all over the world.
Well, the data is valuable, yes, of course, and that's what Cambridge Analytica were using, isn't it, when they downloaded 50 million Facebook users' data. I mean, the point of the data is to make money, and we are, you know, the point of us using Facebook is so that the corporations can make money. Many of the dot-com companies haven't made profits, but there's a subsidiary market in the data which they then collect. And of course, also there are two other things. One is the political use of that data which has been alleged to be involved. What Cambridge Analytica were doing with the data would try and micro-target people to swing votes for Trump or for Brexit. I don't buy that as an argument. I don't buy the argument that they were successful, but that's what they were trying to do. And then the second thing is that it's used by states for security and counter-terrorism work, and that's perhaps the most dangerous element of it, where there's this wholesale surveillance of individuals who have done nothing wrong, won't ever have done anything wrong, but the state is gathering data on them, and they are coming to, as we know, to secret agreements with the corporations to get back doors to some of this data.
What about companies like Palantir? I'm not sure how much you know about them, and the National Security Agency. Zuckerberg is very, very tight-lipped about those. It does seem as if that there are agreements in these social media firms like Facebook with these important national security organisations that the directors are told, well, you simply cannot talk about this, it's a state secret.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the National Security Agency, and of course the equivalent of that in this country is GCHQ, and they are involved and have been involved, as we know from various leaks and everything else, in all sorts of surveillance of individuals' phone and internet traffic, and that they have agreements, as we mentioned, with the corporations that produce this data. But they also then weaponize that in their own propaganda activities. I mean, just the example in GCHQ of JTRIG, the Joint Threat Research Intelligence Group, 120 people, it was in 2011, who gather data on the internet and then fake data on the internet. They create fake websites, do honey traps to try and bring people in who they can then arrest for terrorism charges. They engage in inflating or deflating traffic on websites and fake social media profiles, so that you don't know. Well, when we see stuff about terrorism in the media, we don't know how much of what is said to be out there in the media, how much of this ISIS propaganda, for example, is actually just fake profiles of Facebook users and Twitter users operating out of GCHQ. And they find it difficult sometimes. Some of the documents leaked by Edward Snowden show that they really worry about going away at the weekend, and the person coming in for the weekend shift not having the same kind of grammar or syntax, and they get being found out. But there's a huge amount of effort goes into both surveillance and the manipulation of the internet in order that they can pursue their own interests.
Is that legal for them to do that? I mean, surely there's some sort of state-sponsored, our taxpayers' money paying for this. Is there no control at all?
Well, it's the intelligence services, so they can do more or less what they want, can't they? I mean, there are some laws which can constrain them, but the government, when that material was leaked, the government hasn't said these people are going to be arrested. They haven't mentioned it at all.
Okay, let's get back to the Skripal case and the Salisbury nerve agent business, which has led to the biggest expulsion of Russian diplomats since the Cold War. And we're going to hear now, it's about 3 minutes, it's a clip from chemist Chris Busby. Now, he's one of the people who picked up on this idea of probably a state actor, amongst other things. He's saying he's an organic chemist, and he knows that in any organic chemistry laboratory, if you know what you're doing, you can make this stuff, Novichok. Also, that the whole point of it was that it was a fairly low-tech type of nerve agent that was fairly relatively easy to make. So also, if you had access to any plant in the world which is producing organophosphate pesticides, you could use that to make this nerve agent. But anyway, let's have a listen to just a small clip of the interview that earlier this week that Chris Busby put up on YouTube, up on the internet.
Port and Downer said that they can't identify the material as having come from Russia. Of course, there's a lot of egg on face all over the place, so Boris Johnson and that stupid woman, Theresa May. And they're now saying that they have this evidence, which they have to keep secret, of course, that it came from some facility in Russia. But then the question is, how on earth did they get a sample from that facility in Russia? It's not possible. So they're lying, as usual. They're just trying to cover their back because they're looking stupid, and they're increasingly stupid. The only thing we do know about it is that this material, the exact same material, was synthesized in the United States chemical warfare depot or site in the United States, and somebody put the fragmentation pattern on the scientific NIST, National Institute of Science and Technology website, although they've since taken it off. So we certainly know that the Americans synthesized it, and it's probably quite reasonable to suppose that Port and Dan synthesized it as well. If you want to know my opinion, I believe that this is either material from Port and Dan, or it's material from the United States, and this was a false flag operation along the lines of the same sorts of false flag operations that led to the Iraq War. And the Iraq War, you remember, was fought because of the idea of weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein had, but of course he didn't have anything of the sort. So that was also bogus. And the real reason for the attack of Iraq, which we don't need to go into too much here, but it's about it was because Saddam Hussein had decided to stop paying for his stop asking for dollars for the oil and to sell it in euros. And when Gaddafi decided to do the same thing and set up an Arabic dinar based on gold, he was taken out as well. And then the Syrians decided that they were going to sell oil, not in dollars but in euros, and of course they were invaded too. So what this is all about is the end of the United States empire, the petrodollar empire. Basically, that's it. The Russians have now built the pipelines to China, and they're going to start trading their oil directly with China on the basis of yuan. And China is becoming one of the largest importers of oil now because of its huge expansion. And so they're going to ask the Saudis to start paying in yuan and not in dollars. And so basically the dollar control of trade is going down the toilet rapidly. So of course something has to be done. And what's being done is a war is being engendered. And this is terrifying because the fact is that and this is where my other expertise comes in, that nobody can win such a war if they have even a limited nuclear exchange. If the radioactive materials fall all over the place, then that's the end of it. That's the end of it. This is because the risk model that they have, which tells them, that the stupid people like Theresa May and Boris Johnson, all those stupid fools, possibly Trump as well, the risk model, the radiation risk model that tells those people that they can survive a nuclear war is wrong by factors of up to 10,000 times.
Well, I think that's a pretty good analysis. It might have been better to stick to organic chemistry because he's an organic chemist. But, I mean, the analysis of the political situation of surrounding all of this is pretty accurate. That's what I'd say.
Well, I mean, it's clear, isn't it, that they couldn't say it comes from Russia, that most probably the stuff that they came out with after it was clear that they couldn't say it came from Russia, that they showed it was Russia, is most probably propaganda. And we're left not knowing what has happened in this case. Yulia Skripal has issued a statement, or rather the police have issued a statement for her, which, as Craig Murray, I think, points out, doesn't read very much like a Russian person's statement, even one with very good English. And it's not at all clear what's happening in that case. It's not a straightforward case, but we don't know yet, I think, what's happened in relation to it.
I mean, at the end of the day, what we need to know, if all these Russian diplomats have been expelled, is there any real evidence that Russia was behind this? Because they've denied it, and actually most of the evidence doesn't seem to stack up.
Well, we don't know if it was the Russians or not, but on the face of it, there's been virtually no evidence of any sort which stands up. I mean, the phrase that they use, that term of art they use of a sort developed in Russia, was a joke of a phrase. I mean, it's what they meant was there was allegedly a Novichok program in Uzbekistan when it was part of the Soviet Union, which was then discontinued. And as Craig Murray again said, you know, he personally went to the factory where the program started, and all of this the material was destroyed and confirmed as destroyed by the OPCW, the International Monitoring Body. So there's been no clear evidence that it is the Russians, and we've had lots of statements from the government suggesting it was the Russians, which have turned out to be false. So, you know, on that grounds, I would be sceptical, remain sceptical.
Chris Busby has speculated quite a lot on the motives there. Would you care to?
No, I mean, I wouldn't ever want to speculate on motives. We don't know. I mean, I think keep an open mind. Let's deal with the information we've got and analyse what the information we've got. You know, you speculate on what's happened, you're going to be wrong in the end.
Now let's have a look at the situation last Saturday. We saw this attack, alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma, just on the outskirts of Damascus, which was discussed on BBC Question Time last night. And here's one of the audience contributions then.
The UN has called the biggest humanitarian catastrophe right now is in Yemen. And if our government is so concerned with humanitarian catastrophe, why are we continuing to sell weapons to Saudi?
It's a good point, but
devastating impact in Yemen.
Let me call you back to the question, though.
So that's David Dimbleby saying, actually, Yemen is not relevant. Actually, Martin, perhaps it is. If we wanted to do something about humanitarian issues around the world, isn't Yemen an interesting place to start rather than Syria? What would be the arguments one way or the other?
Well, I mean, Brian Eno has called this kind of thing propaganda, which means that the mainstream media tell you the things that you ought to be worried about. Now, we ought to be worried about chemical weapons in Syria. That's what we've... And then the debate has to be all about that.
Shouldn't we be?
Well, I'm sure we should be in some respects, but in actual fact, there's more people being killed in Yemen with conventional bombs, which we're supplying, and British military personnel are actually involved in the massacre. And, of course, we don't see pictures from Yemen on our TV put up by the White Helmets, who are, in fact, a funded organisation by British taxpayers and US taxpayers. They are funded by us to be the propaganda arm of the Al-Nusra Front, which is the Al-Qaeda franchise in Syria. And of course, plenty of people in Syria are very well aware that the links between Al-Qaeda, ISIS and the Western intelligence services are intimate, because if you remember, the Russians were bombing all of the convoys that were taking oil out of Syria and into Turkey, then to be sold into the international market, and they were the ones who bombed it out of existence, because of course NATO hadn't done any such thing.
Well, something big has changed over the last couple of weeks, and that is that 2 weeks ago we heard this from Donald Trump talking about pulling out completely from Syria.
You're inclined to pull the troops out?
I want to get out. I want to bring our troops back home. I want to start rebuilding our nation. We will have, as of 3 months ago, $7 trillion in the Middle East over the last 17 years. We get nothing out of it. Nothing. So it's time. It's time. We were very successful against ISIS. We'll be successful against anybody militarily. But sometimes it's time to come back home.
Anytime, any place, anywhere where the American troops will go. But they're talking, David, there about actually 2 weeks ago pulling out of Syria. Now everything seems to have gone 180 degrees.
It does. I mean, Trump is a kind of Boris Johnson figure, isn't he? Perhaps he's worse than Boris Johnson. But he says any old crap, and then the job of the neocons and the defence establishment is to change his mind, and they seem to have changed his mind. So that's how to see it, isn't it? That the interests as represented to him have changed, and now they're thinking that an attack on Syria would be a good idea, which of course it wouldn't.
So let's have a listen now to a completely different narrative, which we haven't really heard at all in the Western press, about what happened last Saturday in Douma on the outskirts of Syria. And this is from this character. She's called Syrian Girl. She complains about having her social media accounts taken down, but I managed to grab this. I'm not sure quite how she over-dramatises this, but it was only one video on her channel, and this was it this week. I think she sets up a new channel each week for every new video she puts out, but this is a completely different narrative that we haven't had at all about what happened last Saturday.
Hi everyone, this is Syrian Girl. Syria has been attacked by the US-Israeli-French alliance. Missiles struck the T4 military base, a base that is crucial to the fight against ISIS. This comes right after a false flag chemical attack in the suburb of Douma in Ghouta, Damascus. The neocons are blaming the Syrian government for the chemical attack. But once again, there is no motive, because Assad was winning. After 7 years of war, Ghouta is almost completely liberated from Al-Qaeda-linked rebels. Thousands of civilians have evacuated the city. For years, the rebels weren't allowing them to leave, because they were using them as human shields. most rebel groups in Ghouta surrendered, but one rebel group called the Army of Islam, which controls Douma, refused. This is because they believed that they had leverage in the form of civilian hostages that they kidnapped from a nearby pro-Assad Alawite town called Adra. The Army of Islam, one of the groups the US listed as moderate, kidnapped men, women and children. They put them in cages and paraded them around the city of Douma, saying that if Assad bombs the rebels, the hostages would die. They were literally using them as human shields. Since these civilians were from a pro-Assad Alawite town, the rebels thought that they had more value as human shields than the civilians of Douma. But the war continued, and it looked like the Army of Islam were about to surrender. But suddenly, they stalled negotiations and rained hundreds of missiles down on Damascus city center. You see, some of their members didn't want to surrender. This was when the false flag chemical attack happened. It's obvious the people, the children, that were killed in the gas attack were the hostages that the rebels had kidnapped. The rebels also released footage of perfectly healthy kids being drugged and hosed down. And just look at the timing. A week prior to this attack, Trump said he would pull troops out of Syria. Now he's saying he's going to attack Assad. It's the exact repeat of last year's scenario. The chemical attack that occurred in Idlib on the 4th of April in 2017 occurred almost a year to the day of this attack. And a week prior to that attack, the US said regime change was no longer the objective in Syria. And afterwards, Trump attacked Syria. Also, a day prior to the chemical attack, Israeli President Netanyahu called Trump and told him that he wasn't allowed to pull out of Syria. It's obvious who benefits. It's not the US soldiers that recently died in North Syria. This chemical attack is the excuse that Israel and the neocons need to keep the US troops in Syria indefinitely and have a casus belli for World War III.
Now, we can't verify anything that Syrian girl is saying there, David, but my point really is that this whole scenario where a terrorist group called the Army of Islam could have been behind this attack, we just simply haven't heard anything about that. We haven't heard that there is an alternative narrative.
Not in the mainstream, no. We should be cautious of such a thoroughgoing alternative narrative as that. But we do know some things about the Army of Islam, Jaish al-Islam, which is that they have in the past used chemical weapons in this war. And as she says there, that they are supported by the Americans, also incidentally supported by the British, one of the groups said by the British to be the moderate rebels, not the only group, but one of them. So we do know that they're allied with the West, that they have resources from the West, that the revelations in The Guardian in 2016 are interesting, aren't they? That the British government was paying a PR agency to provide the propaganda and press service of some aspects of the moderate opposition in Syria. So we know that there's significant amounts of money going into that operation and it's being used, presumably, to influence the mainstream media's account of the conflict in Syria. So while we can't, as you say, verify what's in that account, we do know several things about what's happening there which would lead us to doubt some aspects of the official story.
Well, there's another aspect, but you're probably going to hate me for bringing this up as well, David, which is that there's been reports in the Lebanese media and the Syrian media, been reported by the Russians, but not by the Western media, that British special forces have been captured by the Syrian army as they've closed in around this area where this alleged chemical weapons attack took place. And what my point is that a lot of these reports are only being heard in certain parts of the world nowadays, and the mass media here doesn't report them as saying, well, we're getting these reports, we think they're nonsense.
Sure.
They just don't report them at all.
Of course not. Well, I mean, you get some reporting, don't you? I mean, there was reporting in the mainstream media of a special forces death, British special forces operative dying in Syria just the other week. Isolated report. No one says, what? What's happening there? Now, of course, if there is covert British involvement in Syria, which of course there is, we now know there is, then that's there are going to be SAS people and other special forces battalions in there. And where are they going to be? Are they going to be in Assad's territory? No, they're going to be in with the resistance, as they're called. So yeah, of course, this is going to be likely. And the more we hear about this, the better. But the government won't say anything about it because it's a covert operation.
Is that are they allowed to do that sort of thing? I mean, surely there's some kind of scrutiny. Is this just literally the Foreign Secretary, the Defence Secretary, the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defence deciding to do something?
Well,
scrutiny?
There will be scrutiny if the police which can scrutinise this stuff does its job of scrutinising, and that's Parliament. And of course, until recently, there was no prospect whatsoever of any proper scrutiny. You know, the best scrutiny you would get would be from kind of dissident Tories. But now we've got an opposition which has some signs, not many signs maybe, but some signs of being able to scrutinise things properly. And that's the question is whether they can do that. Now, if you look at the pronouncements of Emily Thornberry, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, I wouldn't hold out much prospect of any serious cross-examination of British covert operations in Syria, but there are other parts of the Labour Party which would be interested in doing that. And I the only way it's going to get any proper scrutiny and held to account is if the Labour Party actually deals with this as a serious issue and goes on the front foot on it.
Do you want to answer that, Martin?
Well, I agree with that. Basically, and I think it's still going to be difficult to get scrutiny because these people like not being scrutinised. I mean, they go out of their way to do that. And of course, coming back to the earlier point, the White Helmets are funded by British taxpayers. They're not actually an independent organisation. So when they say, we think they did it and we want you to attack, they openly call for intervention in Syria. But that's British taxpayers who are funding them to make that statement.
David, do you want to say something about some of the organisations these experts come from? We keep hearing experts coming on the radio, the television. Quite often, there isn't really any explanation of what organisation they're from and who might be funding that organisation and whether they're actually independent.
Well, I mean, most people you hear who are described as experts in the area of conflict and security will have some relationship with think tanks or other organisations which have some connection to the military, the police, the intelligence services of the government. So the Atlantic Council is a lobby propaganda group connected to NATO, or there's Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, the oldest think tank in the UK, which has strong connections with both corporations and with the security establishment, or RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, again, similar kinds of connections. So the people you get who are independent analysts, who don't have connections with the state in one form or another, or with these conservative think tanks and policy groups, are very, very small. And if you are an independent expert, you're not going to get on the mainstream media.
What about Bilderberg? This is a subject I've been looking into over the years, and it was quite interesting to see that it was up until recently their main representative in the UK, Ken Clark, who was on their steering committee, who was being put forward as the person who was the voice of reason. But he does want to apparently bomb Syria, but he thinks that Parliament should be consulted.
Well, I mean, Bilderberg is one organisation which is there to bring together elements of the elite across countries to come to common positions. But it's not the only one. A more important organisation these days is the World Economic Forum, but there are many others. There are regional ones, there's ones in the States, there's ones in Spain, organisations of the elite where they get together to become friends, to resolve arguments, to come to common positions. And these are common organisations in the business world to come to common positions on climate change or whatever it is. So yeah, these are organisations which are important, but they're not the organisations that run things.
The one thing Bilderberg does seem to do is has an uncanny habit of inviting future leaders, presidents and politicians, usually 1 or 2 years before they come to power.
It's not uncanny. They spend a lot of time working out who these people are going to be.
And also possibly using their press contacts to help them elevate them
up
into the public mind.
But not only Bilderberg. I mean, the World Economic Forum is essentially an organisation which wants to run the world in business interests, and it has all sorts of connections through its foundation membership of the 1,500 companies which fund it. But there are hundreds of these organisations, and they are all part of the power structure. Yes, along with the think tanks and the lobby groups.
So where do the political parties fit in with this? Are they they fairly low down?
The political parties are either their representatives, as in the case of New Labour or the Tories or the Lib Dems, or they are there to be opposition to them. So, yeah, I mean, they're part of that. They're allies in some respects, and they're their agents in other respects. But they're all part of the political elite which runs the country, right?
OK, so let's have a listen anyway to Ken Clark and his position on Syria now. This was on Channel 4 News last night.
Yeah, I would be in favour of proper, considered, well-targeted military action. Indeed, I think it should be, there should be a response, because it stopped Assad last time, and he's trying it on again because Trump had led him to believe he was pulling everything out of Syria and he'd lost interest in Syria, so he's tried again. And if we don't actually take punitive reaction, then he will start using chemical weapons, because it's a quicker way of winning urban battles, and I think other groups will start doing the same thing in the Middle East. But it needs parliamentary approval first. I think that the planned policy use of military force in a significant way is subject to parliamentary approval if we have an effective parliamentary democracy worth calling the name in modern times. I think, as I was one of those who forced Tony Blair reluctantly to have a vote on the Iraq war, as I approved of David Cameron submitting the decision to a parliamentary vote when he wanted to intervene in Syria, I think it's quite absurd to start invoking what I regard as the archaic argument of the royal prerogative, which means actually that the Prime Minister, with the advice of her cabinet, is put into a dictatorial position when it comes to making war against other countries. I don't think that's acceptable. I think it would be a further pathetic weakening of Parliament's power.
Well, I don't obviously agree with his analysis of who actually carried out the attack. I think it's far more likely to be Jaish al-Islam and working with the Western intelligence services, probably the Saudis, possibly ourselves. But leaving that aside, let's come to the actual thing of a parliament deciding whether to go to war or not. They did do that over Libya and Syria, and of course we didn't go to war with Syria last time, and it stopped the Americans going to war because Ed Miliband put his foot down and said, we're not doing this. So that they're worried about that, and opinion polls show that 44% of people are opposed to attack Syria, and only 22% are in favour of it, and of course the others don't know and they just need to hear the arguments. So there's a question whether Parliament should be involved and all the rest of it. But I think, like, if there was a debate in Parliament, you ought to ask them, what actually is your military strategy here? Because you're just saying you're going to fire off a few missiles at targets in Syria, and you're presuming that the Russians and the Syrians won't fire back. Putin's speech that he made before he was elected pointed out that the new weaponry that the Russians have got renders naval warfare obsolete. They can fire from inside Russia and sink the entire naval armada that's steaming into the Mediterranean now. Now, they won't probably do that, but they could, and they might. And what's extraordinary about people like talking about military action here is how little understanding they have of what the military options actually are, because they're minimal to non-existent.
Well, what's your guess, David, as to what's going to happen?
Well, it's extremely worrying, isn't it? I mean, I think that what I would say is that there are many people who are seeing the horror in Syria and who are tremendously concerned about that, but are not as concerned as they perhaps should be about the possibility of war with Russia. I mean, that would be an absolute disaster for the world. And the way in which even some elements of the left have encouraged Russophobia, the notion of Russian bots or Russian involvement in Skripal or Russiagate in the US, all of this is just encouraging a kind of anti-Russian hysteria that takes you back to the Cold War, to the period where Bob Dylan memorably sang in 1964 about how he'd learned to hate the Russians all through his whole life, and if it was another war to come, it was them we must fight. We're in a period which is incredible, incredible anti-Russian hysteria based on literally nothing. Of course, you know, the Russians have their own foreign policy and international objectives, and they are a state with interests with which one needs to deal, but this is ridiculous. We're in a period where there's an encouragement, even by someone on the left, of a anti-Russian hysteria, which could have profoundly damaging consequences for everyone in this country.
So what can we do to sort of fix the system? It doesn't seem to be quite working, does it? I mean, Ken Clark was talking about dictatorial powers there.
The system hasn't worked for a long time, but we know that, right? We know that it doesn't work. We know that the only way that we're going to stop it is like we almost did in Iraq, where we have millions of people in the streets. The only way of stopping these people is by holding them to account. And the thing which stops them is either opposition in parliament, which becomes generalised enough, or opposition in the streets.
Thanks, David Miller, Professor of Sociology at Bath University. Thanks very much for joining us. Almost a whole hour we spent there talking about this whole business of the Skripal poisoning and the decisions being made over whether or not to attack Syria, effectively kind of by NATO, the Anglo-Zionist Empire. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook, hopefully, we'll have Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, they were Labour councillor for Avonmouth and Lawrence Weston, Donald Alexander, Lib Dem leader and councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. Also thanks to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our sister show Dialects on next Tuesday at noon, where you can hear some fascinating accounts of the Irish Holocaust. Apparently it wasn't a famine, because the British Army at gunpoint were marching shiploads of food out of Ireland in the 1840s. So you can't really describe that as a famine, can you? That's on Dialect next Tuesday, and you can catch it online now at dialectradio.co.uk. This show's story links and comment page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. You can download our MP3s, and you can listen in the car, iPlayer, or anywhere you like. Even if you're on BBC Question Time, you could probably listen to them whilst you're sitting on the panel, actually, with something in your earphones. Also, you'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable time. And Billy Quain's Saturday edition tomorrow morning at 10. Get the real musical deal Sunday evening at 7 with Danny Lopsch. Do please join us on the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. We're on from 6 till 8 now, not 5 till 7, 6 till 8. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men. Shooting foes. Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell. The cries of the...
And on your mobile... BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.